There's a place called Real America. I heard about it from a rich politician. It magically appears, especially in election years. Life is good in real America. It's like living with a thousand Sarah Palins. You stroll Main Street hand in hand and take a ride to fantasy land. Let's go to real America. Happy meal America, where we can be proud, we don't talk well. Meet me in real America, U.S. Steel America, at the corner of Norman and Rockwell. Things are real in real America. And up is down, and Joe the plumber is a genius. They've got just two stoplights. No one steals and no one fights for civil rights. Let's go to real America, Oldsmobile America. Shove the kids in the backseat and bring them along to real America. Good housekeeping, seal America. All done up in denim and gingham. I don't know who they got there, but I can tell you who's not there. Ain't none of them Ivy League elites, not a one of them San Francisco treats. Ain't none of them wine and tofu snobs, not a one of them Daily Show whack jobs. Ain't none of them corporate media sluts, not a one of them academia nuts. Ain't none of them friggin' Francophiles, not a one of them New York non-Gentiles. I believe in real America. And so I vote against my economic interests. Let's go to real America. Deal or no deal, America. I can't tell you how happy I'd be if I get to go to real America. Norman Vincent Peale, America. Where Ronald Reagan is deified. In real America. Uh-huh. Real America. Well, duh. Where no one uses profanity. 'Cause they're so full of Sean Hannity.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Climate Warriors. Michael Mann warns that we can't allow science to be killed. We can't allow the scientific agenda to be set by those who have vested interests to not have the truth unveiled. Over the past decade, climate science has become increasingly politicized. Climate scientists who have taken on public roles cope with personal threats, hacking assaults, and assaults on their professional integrity. Michael Mann and Catherine Hayhoe and Bill Andergreg discuss their experiences as climate scientists in a field under the magnifying glass of politics, economics, and amplified emotions. And then after that, Barbara Jordan makes the keynote address in the 1976 Democratic Convention.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. 7 years ago, there was a broad political consensus in Washington, D.C. that burning fossil fuels releases heat-trapping gases that could alter the Earth's atmosphere. John McCain, Newt Gingrich, and coal state Democrats accepted the fundamentals of climate science and the need to reduce carbon emissions. Today, it's a different story. Republicans and Democrats are loath to mention climate, and the percentage of Americans who say humans are the primary cause of global warming is much lower than it was in the second term of President George W. Bush. Skeptics are winning the climate communication battle, even as temperatures rise and the number and intensity of floods and droughts increases worldwide. Over the next hour, we'll discuss the politicization of high school physics and chemistry and how science is communicated in the public realm. Along with our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, we're joined by three distinguished scientists. Michael Mann is professor of geosciences at Penn State and author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Catherine Hayhoe is professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas Tech University and co-author of A Climate of Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. And Bill Andrag is a graduate student at Stanford University who is researching forests in the American West. Please welcome them to Climate One. I should mention that Bill Andrag is pinch hitting on very short notice for Terry Root, who couldn't be here today due to a family emergency. So thank you for stepping in on short notice. Michael Mann, you published a seminal work study on the hockey stick. So tell us what the hockey stick is and how you got hit in the head with it.
Well, it's not a sports implement. It's actually a curve that my co-authors and I published more than a decade ago, which attempted to reconstruct temperatures back in time. We only have about a century of widespread thermometer records around the world. So to place modern warming in a longer-term context, we have to turn to what we call proxy data, things like tree rings and corals and ice cores, to piece together the puzzle of how the climate varied in the more distant past. And what this curve showed was that while it was relatively warm about 1,000 years ago, as far back as we could go, the recent warming exceeded anything that we've seen for at least the past 1,000 years. The graph became an icon in the climate change debate. It was featured in the summary for policymakers of the 2001 Fourth Assessment Report, third assessment report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And when it became an icon in the climate change debate, those who find the science of climate change inconvenient saw the need to try to discredit this graph. And indeed, they saw discrediting me as a way of trying to do that. And so much like many of my colleagues, my other climate science colleagues in the past have been attacked, even vilified for the work that they've done that demonstrates the reality of climate change, so too was I vilified for the hockey stick. And my book tells the story of what it's like to be a scientist and to find yourself sort of an involuntary and accidental public figure. And what I've tried to do, if I'm going to be put in the limelight in the way that our detractors have tried to put me in the limelight, I'm going to try to take advantage of that. And the book was part of my effort to do that.
Catherine Hayhoe, you say that you're willing to take it in the neck, and if not, you're not talking to the right people. What do you mean by that?
Not to continue the hockey stick metaphor. Yeah, instead of getting whacked over
you
the
You are
head,
Canadian, by the way. So
I am. I have my own, and it's actually a real one. I feel like with climate change being so divisive right now, so polarized, that if we as scientists are not getting attacked, then we're not talking to the right people. I feel a little bit almost like, a doctor who ran a test and found a red flag of some potential disease you could have and decided not to tell you because they're afraid that you'd be angry at them. I mean, that's ridiculous, but I feel like with climate scientists, we're the same way. We're taking the temperature of the planet, we're seeing some red flags, and we have a responsibility to tell people about that.
Bill Andrag, you're relatively new to this field. Did you know what you were getting into when you decided to pursue a career in atmospheric science, that these kinds of personal attacks would be part of the career you chose?
A little bit. I mean, having studied under Stephen Schneider and watching the experiences of Mike Mann and Catherine Hayhoe and others, I was prepared for the public scrutiny of a study, but we did a study on climate change and the proportion of scientists that sort of agree with this synthesis by the Intergovernmental Panel, and it's incredibly high, 97-98%, and I was certainly not prepared for the personal nature and the kind of immediacy of the backlash that was accompanied this study.
So what happened? You published a report that said they questioned the scientific qualifications of the so-called scientists who are skeptics, and what happened? What was the consequence?
Well, so our study did two things. First, we found that there was an incredibly high agreement behind what the IPCC had articulated as the main components of human-caused climate change. And then second, that those who are publicly doubting and expressing their lack of agreement essentially were not very well qualified, that the vast majority of them did not publish in the scientific literature. They hadn't studied atmospheric science or fields relevant. And the backlash was really immediate, that the hate emails came in quite rapidly. The blogosphere was sort of an amplifier to this, that it picked up these messages and suddenly, your email address, and this has happened to plenty of climate scientists, suddenly your email address is across a dozen blogs that are not very friendly.
Catherine Hayhoe, does this have a chilling effect?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when people post your picture and your email address and encourage others to send you nasty emails, of course it can. I mean, I had the experience one time of opening my mail in the morning after I'd been on the O'Reilly Show the night before and having over 200 messages from people I didn't know in a single morning. Out of those 200, one was nice. And the others were anywhere from unpleasant to actually downright evil.
And Mike Mann, Freedom of Information Act requests. You have a couple of attorney generals who, I mean, you...
Just one attorney general.
One attorney general? Okay, only one.
It's enough.
But you really have had a target on your back because of the hockey stick. What's that experience been like?
Well, you know, I believe that, you know, the attacks against me and other climate scientists are intended to have a chilling effect. They're intended to make an example out of us for others who might think of stepping up and participating in the public discourse or publishing scientific findings that have implications for, you know, human-caused climate change. I've also opened letters, like Catherine. One letter contained a white substance, and I actually had to have the FBI come in, and there was police tape over the door of my my office at Penn State University. They had to send the material off to a lab. Fortunately, it turned out it was a harmless substance. It was only intended to intimidate me. It was only intended to send a chilling message to me. But that's, you know, part of the life of being a climate scientist today, participating in the public discourse.
Mm-hmm. So when you are looking at a prospective research project, do you think, well, that one's kind of hot, I'm not going to touch that one, I better, you know, something like that? Does it affect your research choices and how you go about your job?
Well, not me. I mean, I've already made a commitment. You know, I'm going to go down this road. You know, this is, I see, you know, the attacks against me have actually led me to recognize the importance of not being intimidated by these sorts of tactics, by not sending setting an example for younger scientists who might decide that, well, hey, maybe I should go into this other field. That is, I think, in part what our detractors would like to see. They would like to see a barrier set up to prevent other scientists from doing research that might have implications for, you know, our burning of fossil fuels and policies related to carbon emissions. We can't allow science to be chilled. We can't allow the scientific agenda to be set by those who have vested interests to not have the truth be unveiled.
Let's.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Let's talk a little bit about who these people are, motivations. Catherine Hayhoe, you said that these skeptics or deniers actually have quite a firm grasp of facts, and that they actually have facts on, they're well-informed. They may be, expound on that.
Well, my own personal experience living in West Texas is that the people that I meet in the grocery store or walking down the street or in the office next door, they know more about the issues surrounding climate change than the average person would who says, oh, we have to take action right away. Because they don't think it's a real problem, they have all these reasons to back up why they don't. And so that's why I don't believe that facts are enough. Now, as a scientist, I do think that facts are enough. But in realizing that this is not necessarily an issue of facts, it's an issue of fear. There is an enormous amount of fear that we are dealing with an issue where the impacts are distant and far away, but the solutions are imminent, and people fear them as being very costly and infringing on our freedom, our economy, and our rights. So there's many emotional issues attached to this, and I really feel like it's an issue of emotions, not facts, because to circle back to the question you asked Mike, do I think about which research projects to do? No, because I don't get it for a research project. I get it for standing up in public and saying, climate is changing, humans are the cause, and we're seeing the impacts. That's what we get it for. It's not new research. It's the basic facts that we have known for decades.
And so are you saying that facts don't persuade people? That it have to come in a different way? How do you communicate then with someone who's a skeptic or denier? It's not facts. How do you do it?
There's certainly a few people who facts are very important to, but like I said, it's gotten to the point where it's an emotional issue. It's about fear. It's about thinking that I'm a conservative and conservatives don't think this is true. Or I'm a person of faith, and this is incompatible with my faith. It challenges the sovereignty of God. It challenges things that we hold dear and near to our hearts, not our brains. So that's why I feel like it's so important to start with the values that we share. We all live on this planet. We all want a better life for our children. We want a healthy economy. Those of us who hold to almost any major faith believe that creation is something to be taken care of, that people are to be loved. And so when we start from these shared values and then we build a case for taking action on climate change, we're starting from the identities that people already have instead of trying to make green tree huggers of the world.
Michael Mann, you've written about 6 stages of denial. Walk us through quickly those. It's compatible with...
Well, so we've seen this retreat over, you know, since the time that I came into the science of climate change back in the early 1990s. Originally, the claim made by those who deny the threat of climate change, the claim was that the Earth wasn't warming. That soon became untenable because there was solid enough evidence that was mounting, not just thermometer records, but independent lines of evidence that tell us that the planet is warming. So the next stage of denial is then, well, okay, it's warming, but this is part of a natural cycle. Then, of course, that becomes untenable because of the work that climate scientists have done that demonstrate that the warming we've seen is not consistent with the pattern of what we would expect if it were natural causes rather than human factors that were responsible for the warming. So it goes on down that sort of... So then, you know, the argument would be, of course, well, okay, well, maybe it is part of that warming is due to human impacts, but it's pretty small, and it's not going to be very much in the future. The climate, the sensitivity of the climate system is at the low end of what the scientists say. And then eventually that becomes untenable. The science is pretty clear now on the fact that the climate system is quite sensitive. We're seeing that in the Arctic right now. We're seeing that Arctic sea ice is retreating at a schedule that, in fact, is decades ahead of what the models were projecting. We're actually seeing changes unfold faster than what we expected. And then ultimately, and somewhat ironically, eventually it comes full circle. Okay, well, it's too late to do anything about it anyways, so we might as well just adapt to what's coming. And so one has to recognize that denial does take various forms, and I think there are multiple constituencies that we're speaking to. It isn't a monolithic constituency.
Let's talk about that. There is some work done by Yale and George Mason University called the 6 Americas that really breaks down sort of the approaches that Americans have toward climate change from alarmed, concerned, cautious, disengaged, doubtful, and dismissive. So, Catherine Hayhoe, how do you fine-tune your message to those different types of people?
We're actually working on exactly that right now with some people who are experts in social psychology, media, and marketing. Because, again, see, it's going off of the science. It's into us. We're people. How do we react to facts? How do we react to information? We all have different values. We all have different things that motivate us. And so we have to recognize that for one person, making a better world for their child might be paramount. For another person, national security might be the issue that moves us. For someone else, a sense of responsibility, loving our neighbor, or stewarding creation might be what moves us to the next step. So even though there's a one-size-facts-fit-all, there's not a one-size-message-fits-all.
And that's a new thing within the scientific community. You are not trained to be communicators. You're trained to be researchers. Mm-hmm. Communication is not what you're paid for. It's not what gets you tenure. It's not what gets you professional accolades, et cetera. This is something on top of what you're all trained and expected to do. Mm-hmm. So how are you doing at that?
Well, we're doing it because, like I said, we have a responsibility, I feel like. We have this issue, I think I probably speak for all of us here, that if we hold silent on it, who will speak? We are not in this because we value people's opinions of us. We are not in this because we want to receive pleasant emails in the morning. We're in it because this is the truth, and we have to tell it.
Catherine Hayhoe is a professor at Texas Tech. We're also talking with Michael Mann and Bill Andreg at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. Then you've also been a key person speaking to communities of faith, and that's one of the most powerful levers, a lot of people in faith. So how do you get over that God sovereignty issue that humans can't affect creation?
That is actually a fairly common question, but it's easy to answer. Just look around us today. Do we see things happening that are bad? Do we see consequences of poor choices that we've made all the time? Somebody has a drink too many, gets in the car, kills an innocent person. We make poor health choices. It leads to health issues later in life. We see all the time evidence of reaping what we have sowed. And there's even verses in the Bible that tell us that. So there's no way challenges God's sovereignty. Rather, it's a reflection of the free will that he's given us to make choices and then to bear the consequences of those choices.
Michael Mann, anything to add to that?
I think that at some level, whether you want to frame this in terms of religious faith or ethics, to me, we focus so much on climate change as an issue of science or an issue of policy or economics, cost-benefit analysis, but not often enough do we frame it for the issue that it really is ultimately. It's an issue of our ethical obligation. I have a daughter, you know, who's 7 years old, and I want to make sure that we don't make decisions today, that we don't lock, that we don't lock in a future, a degraded earth for her children and grandchildren through the decisions we are making now with our fossil fuel emissions. We have gained economically from access to cheap, dirty sources of energy, but there's a very real cost of that, and that cost is going to be borne increasingly down the road. We still have time to avert a future where we leave our children and grandchildren a degraded planet, but there isn't a whole lot of time to do that.
The late, great Stephen Schneider once said that basically our strategy has been, we'll make our kids richer and then they'll have money to figure it out, to deal with it, right? It's like, we're going to leave you some money and good luck, here's some money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so how, what's it going to be like for our children? Well, I mean, your models predict 6 or 7 year olds. I have an 8 year old daughter. They may live to the end of this century. What are they looking at?
Well, there's still time to prevent what most scientists classify as, what would constitute a truly dangerous impacts on the planet as far as climate change is concerned, another 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming. We can prevent that. We would need to prevent CO2 concentrations from reaching about 450 parts per million. For every million parts of air, 450 of them being CO2 molecules. Pre-industrial levels were 280. Right now, they're about 394. Next year, if we were sitting in this room, they would be about 397. The year after that, 400. You can see that we get to 450 pretty soon if we don't make some dramatic changes with our carbon emissions. And so if you do the math, and my good friend Bill McKibben has been going around the country with his Do the Math tour talking about the numbers that are involved. And ultimately, we can still prevent dangerous impacts on our planet, on our climate. But we have to bring our fossil fuel emissions to a peak within a matter of years. We have to ramp them down dramatically in the decades ahead. And it's going to require a major investment of infrastructure, a shift to renewable energy sources. We can do it. There's nothing preventing us from doing it other than willpower.
Mm-hmm. How much of it's already baked? Sorry, Catherine Hayhoe.
Oh, I was just going to say that what I study specifically is bringing this global issue down to the local scale. And what I found is that in 9 cases out of 10, the reason why we care about climate change is not because it's introducing a new problem that we've never seen before in the places where we live. It's because it's interacting with existing stressors or vulnerabilities we've already built into the system. Here in California, half of the water comes from Sierra Nevada snowpack, and there isn't enough to go around today. What happens as it gets warmer and that snowpack melts in the winter? Come spring, the Central Valley farmers will not have the water that they need, and there already isn't enough. In West Texas, we're taking our water out of an aquifer. In 50 years, we have drained half the aquifer. It's not coming back. Where are we going to get our water then? As it gets warmer, we need more of it. In the Northeast, you have big cities built right at sea level. They're already vulnerable to storms today, as we saw. What happens as sea level increases? We've built these vulnerabilities into our system, and as the world warms, we're going to see increasing risks that we have already built into our cities, our agriculture, our water, and our energy.
And is that water vulnerability percolating into the political system and the public consciousness in Texas?
In Texas, when you buy your property, you buy the water rights to the property. And so up until now, you have had the ability to withdraw unlimited amounts of water from the aquifer. For the first time, they are attempting to limit what you can take out of the aquifer, and people are up in arms because that's your freedom. It's been taken away. Mm-hmm. So things are changing.
And when you say up in arms, you really mean arms.
Yeah, I do. Yes.
We'll be right back. but you can't look away. I make you think I'm delicious with the stuff that I say. I'm the best you can get. Have you guessed me yet? I'm the slime oozing out from your TV set. You will obey me while I lead you in the garbage that I feed you until the day that we don't need you. Don't go for help, no one will heed you. Your mind is totally controlled. It has been stuffed into my mold, and you will do as you are told until the rights to you are sold.
That's right, folks. Don't touch that dial.
Well, I am the slime from the big yard, who's laying alone on the living room floor. I am the slime from the big yard.
Now for something completely different.